You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 576. Back to the regular format for 1 week. Let's go. It's the Punk News Podcast, and we're back, and this week we have, returning after, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks away, finally, Sammy B. Dangerous back in town and ready to rack him up. Sammy B., what's happening?
I'm here. I'm alive.
Well, that's a start. It's always a pleasure to have Sammy B. on the podcast, always bringing the knowledge of the New Jersey and New York punk scene, always fighting on behalf of pop punk and sad boy punk and sad girl punk, and always fighting on behalf of the Bouncing Souls, Sammy B., the true defender of the New Jersey and New York scenes, always back, always great to have you, and someone that will see the bright side of things, and when there's only dark side of things, she'll just say, well, there's only dark side of things. So here we are, Sammy B., back in town, and we're also here with M-more. Last week, hey, we did the first Punk's Points in 3 years, and frankly, about 3 years ago, I kind of said, well, let's not do Punk's Points again, because the one 3 years ago was kind of dry, and it didn't have the pop. But I got to say, last week's Punk's Points, I really feel like it had some real pop, and I kind of want to do another Punk's Points sooner rather than later, frankly. Like, I felt that was like a lot of fun last week.
It was a blast. It was awesome. Yeah, I'd definitely be up for doing more.
I think honestly, I usually boohoo technology, but here now with modern technology, we had buzzers and we had a screen that people pick from. I think that kind of made a lot more fun. The only thing is, and Sam, you can weigh on this too, is I try to make the questions like interesting to listen to. Like, I don't want every question, what's the first album by the Ramones? What's the third album by the Clash? Like, that's not interesting. So I try to have random factoids, like who produced the first Germs record, the only Germs record. The answer is Joan Jett. But I feel as though those random factoids make questions very difficult. So I wonder if the questions were too difficult, or maybe we should make the first three basically gimmies and the last two difficult. So Sam and Em, what was your opinion of the difficulty of Punk's Points? Because to me, they're always easy, but that's because I already know the answer. So if you already know the answer, of course it's easy. You know, I'm like, oh,
wait, yeah. So I think what you should do is put all of the questions in a basket, roll it around like bingo, and pull them out one by one.
So you think we shouldn't have the Jeopardy board like we use?
You can do Jeopardy, but I'm just saying, you know, it's just an idea. You know, make it super random.
I do enjoy the chaos aspect there. I will say, I think there's too many difficult ones. Like, do you think we had too many hard questions, or what do you think?
I think the last half of the second round, not a lot of people got points, and a lot of people lost points. So I think the second half of the last round was harder. But like some of the harder questions, like, they're really interesting because it's like, oh, I didn't know that. Like, that's really cool, you know? So from a trivia aspect, I like the hard questions. But for like getting people to win, you know?
Mm.
Yeah, but I don't know, because they're cool, and it's funny to see people go like, ah, you know.
I think maybe, like you said, I'll do like the first three easy and the last two hard. And the other thing is, and I don't know if there's a really solution for this, and there probably isn't, is I'm pretty sure every single time we've played Punk's Points, or maybe every single time except one, basically one person has dominated and the other two people have kind of competed with each other, but not like the main person. I mean, is there any way around that? I don't know if there is, you know.
No, I don't think there's any way around it. I think it just depends on what we all know, right? And if you're selecting people, we don't know what Like, I'm sure you don't know what I know in this brain.
That's and like I said, and then we'll start the podcast. The other issue is that I keep most of the questions are old school. I wonder if we should include more new. See, what's nice about old school is presumably everybody's got kind of an old school background, or everybody knows the Sex Pistols, everybody knows the Clash. But you know, are most people going to know From Ashes Rise, or are most people even going to know facts about Turnstile? Like, are people going to know the name of the first Turnstile album, or you know, the first Angel Dust album? Even though that stuff's popular right now, I don't know if that's as universal as Sex Pistols, Misfits, and that kind of a thing, you know?
Well, I think it also depends on the person, because, like, I didn't get into punk, like, you know, until, like, contemporary days. So, like, I might not know every Clash question, you know? Because I just don't listen to them. So, but, you know, I right, might Sam, get something sure, like sure. Turnstile, like...
All right, Sam. Which drummer drummed for both the? Oh, wait, that's not even the right question. Never mind. All right, Sam. Oh, here you go, Sam. Who was in both the Clash and Public Image Limited?
I wouldn't know that. You're asking the wrong person.
There you have it. All right. So anyway, Punk's points will be back. Honestly, maybe in a month, or maybe 2 or 3 months. But honestly, definitely within at least 4 months, I'd say, because I really want to play again. I love playing. I think we'll have maybe slightly easier questions and maybe 5 categories instead of 6. But I'm psyched for it. Anyways, you can always use that podcast at punknews.org. And next week we will be having our end of year episode, which I am super looking forward to. Let's play a song and then we'll come back. Sam, you got a song to play, or what's the deal?
Sure. So I saw Turnover at some point this year. You know, I think I was in LA watching Joyce Manor, and Turnover was there. So anyways, I'm really like into their 2019 album altogether. So this is Number on the Gate.
Why you wanna come through now? Did you see it?
and that was turnover doing On the Gate, almost as good as Apple Turnover, which is a really good band. And so, it's, you know, Sam, I used to see Joyce Manor, but I used to see them back in the day when they were like an Asian Man Records band, and there was like 14 people there. And I never even went to see Joyce Manor. It was always like Bond Music Industry with Joyce Manor opening, or Classic of Love, and Joyce Manor's going to be there too. And then Joyce Manor just exploded. That was like when they had like that album that was like 14 minutes long, including a cover of... Let me see if I can remember. It was a cover of like a 90s song. Was it Video Killed the Radio Star was the cover on it? Was that the cover?
Hold on. We could look this up, I think.
Or maybe it was Millions of Peaches. Peaches for Me. Millions of Peaches. no. Anyway, I used to see them all the time. And I'm not a hater, but to me, it wasn't anything like really that special. But people, even at the onset, people like adored that band. And the cover was Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles. M, what is the importance of the Buggles and music videos?
First music video.
Correct. First music video played on MTV.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's get the podcast started. So this is interesting. Speaking of Video Killed the Radio Star, Digital Killed the Physical Star, or did it? This past year, 2021, was the first year in 17 years that CD sales were higher than in the previous year, which CDs have been declining rapidly, mostly due to digital streaming, but also somewhat in part to vinyl, which we're going to talk about in a hot second. But in 2021, CDs sold higher than the previous year, and however, it might be a fluke. And the reason is because both Adele and Taylor Swift released CDs. Adele released her 30, which was a highly anticipated album, and she sold 898,000 units. Taylor Swift collectively sold, let's see, just over 1 million units. Because she released 4 albums last year, which was 1 original and 3 remakes of older albums. And then BTS also released an album. They sold 1.03 units of all their albums together. So together, Taylor Swift, Adele, and BTS were 7.1% of all CDs sold in 2021 in USA, which is crazy that 4 artists would sell almost 10% of all CDs. That means 1 out of every 10 CDs sold was a Taylor Swift CD, an Adele CD, or a BTS CD, which really is crazy. I think a big part of that is Walmart and Target, which we can talk about that if we want to. If Adele had not sold a CD this year or released an album this year, then CDs would have been lower this year and followed the trend. Notably, catalog CDs, which are CDs that are 18 months or older, continue the decline. So the question is, are CDs somewhat rebounding? Because now that vinyl is super expensive, here and there you hear whispers of people saying CDs are back on the rise. The kids want CDs. I don't fully buy that, frankly. Maybe it's a small blip, but I don't think CDs are the new records, frankly. But the first question is, are CDs coming back? Are they holding? Or is this just a irregularity due to both Taylor Swift and Adele releasing CDs? Similar to that, vinyl, Christmas week 2021 had its biggest week since at least 1991. And the reason we say at least 1991 is because that's when they started tracking vinyl sales per week. And when we say vinyl sales, we mean new vinyl scanned through the MRC data system, which basically means vinyl records scanned with a barcode. So that would not include used records, obviously, but also would not include ones sold through mail order or ones that aren't scanned or ones in the record store where the record store doesn't scan the record. They just put in, 1995 or whatever. So vinyl had a gigantic week, Christmas week. And of course, as everyone knows, over the past 4 or 5 years now, vinyl has rapidly risen. In the past 2 years, it's just gone off the charts, and vinyl is as big as it was at least in the 90s, and it is beginning to rival what it was in the 80s, which of course was the height of vinyl. Although I do wonder if vinyl per capita in the 80s, how that matches up to vinyl per capita in 60s and 70s. But that being said, number of vinyl records sold is approaching the insane number of the 80s, which is, as a side note, it was mammoth crazy news that Adele sold almost 1 million CDs in a year. Sam, what do you think the Backstreet Boys sold on their main, like their big album, their CD, the first week?
A couple of hundreds of thousands.
Oh, more than that. Is Millennium the big one?
Yes, Millennium is the one that I waited online at Best Buy to buy, yes.
Yeah, that was the big one. 27 million CDs sold worldwide, 11 million sold the year of release, and about 4 million sold, no, 6 million the week of release, you see. And so it is amazing that Adele is probably about as big as Backstreet Boys were in 1999, at least the same ballpark, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and so it's usually that she almost sold a million, whereas in the 90s, 6 million was the target, you see.
When Backstreet Boys was doing their thing, though, like, all we were getting was CDs.
that's my point, is that's the impact that streaming has had. So, Sam, there's a lot to unpack there. Are CDs back? Is it a fluke? Do you dig CDs? And records, everyone's saying they're back. They're here to stay. Hooray. Vinyl forever. I'm not buying it, Sam. I'm saying big vinyl crash in the next couple of years. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, like, you know, as much as I love vinyl, I really hate spending $30 on one album. So I'm hoping the bubble bursts soon because I want affordable vinyl. My husband and I, yes, we still have a CD collection, although we have not really bought new CDs since, I guess, like 15 years ago or something like that. So we've just been buying vinyl because it's been coming with a download card. So I think this is a fluke. I definitely think it's because T-Swift and Adele did put something out, because I think T-Swift put out like all of her copies of things, right? Taylor's versions of things, all at the same time or roughly at the same time this year. So I think, like, you know, all of her fans probably ran out to buy the CDs to support her and not that other guy, the one that stole her stuff.
I'm going to interrupt Sam. Taylor Swift did something really rad and very punk. And actually, we were discussing that. It was pretty punky before. Someone did an article in The Atlantic, and I wish I had pitched The Atlantic. Actually, Taylor Swift is very punk, because what happened was this guy's name is Scooter Braun. His name is Scooter. He bought her catalog. A grown man called himself Scooter. I always say the Muppet Baby, Scooter the Muppet Baby. This guy, basically, somehow he finagled to buy her catalog from the record label, and that this is her sound recordings, not her her publishing or compositions, which we'll talk about later on. And so then she, for some reason, he was like really creepy to her, like even before, like they had like this weird history where he hated her and she hated him. And then he bought her catalog, which is a totally pervy and weird thing to do. Of all the catalogs to buy, you know, you buy the person that you hate. So it's definitely a weird thing going on there. And everyone's like, you know, this guy's creepy. And so Taylor said, well, I'm going to fix him. And he actually sold his catalog. But what Taylor did, she's like, well, I'm going to go re-record all the albums that he bought out from under me. And that way I'm going to have or even quarter his streaming and get that money for myself. And so Taylor re-recorded all her albums just like the old blues guys did in the 50s and 60s. And so she basically, whoever bought that from Scooter Braun, like their investment was basically completely blown out of the water because Taylor halved it or even quartered the value of the property just with her re-recording of it and her flooding the market with different sound recordings. Go ahead, Sam. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So pretty much I do think that because she did this year, I do think that's what made a rise in the CD sales that probably would not happen. So for BTS, I know BTS does not really put out records. I think they put out 7 inches of like singles and things like that. And that's even hard to get in the States, I think. Because I've been walking around and apparently places I walk around has an entire K-pop section of music. So I do know that, like, you know, if you're into K-pop, they're still very CD based. So,
It's interesting. The two interesting things there, and we're not going to get off on a K-pop tangent. You think that because records are so popular, that the American labels would just make BTS on record in America? I mean, kids of that age, kids that are buying Taylor Swift and what's her name, Billie Eilish, like they're buying records. So you think they would just make BTS records, but they don't. Also, I realize BTS is Korean and it's K-pop, but in Japan, CD is still the dominant form of music use.
Form.
Weird, right? Because Japan is traditionally the head of technology, and now the CD is considered a passe form, but people still want CDs in Japan. And I don't blame them. I love CDs.
Well, they don't have the space for, you know, record collections. You actually have to, like you actually have to want to keep these things and for these things to spark joy in order for you to keep it. Like, I've been to Japan, and all of the hotels I've stayed at in Japan that was affordable for my budget was tiny. So, like, you know, I can only imagine the people that actually live in Japan, like, you know, there are spaces, especially if you're, like, living in Tokyo, right? It's a metropolitan city. You know, I don't see them having, like, you know, rooms of records. Maybe
Sam brings up a great thing that I hadn't considered. I think Sam cracked it, and we're getting way off on a tangent, and we'll bring it back with M. But in Japan, CDs are popular and not streaming and not vinyl. And Sam brings up a great point in that in Japan, the tradition of collecting and cherishing art goes back thousands of years. So Japan has traditionally always been very big in that, but they don't have the room. So the CD kind of solves both those problems, doesn't it?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
M, CDs, yes. Are they here to stay? Vinyl, are they here to stay? And is this a reaction? Is it the young people's reaction? Because they're accustomed to streaming, so they want something physical. What's the deal? What's going on? Give us sound economic advice so we can invest in CDs and records or liquidate our assets.
And I'll throw in some stock recommendations too. Get on the phone with your investor. I really hope CDs are here to stay. I love CDs. CDs are great. If more people buy CDs, more CDs will be made, and the price will drop, and I need the price to drop because it's ridiculous. Because, like, you get a cool, like, case, and it's protected, and, like, the art on the disc looks cool, and, you know, you can carry them around with you, and we have an old car, so it has a CD player, and it's great, and yeah, you get the little lyric book and everything. Like, there's just nonstop pluses to CDs, you know? Like, just, you can play them in your computer, I think. You have a disc thing? Yeah. you know, like, it's just, they're so cool and they're fun and they're neat. So I think that's part of it, you know? Like, it's for young people, I guess, like, maybe it would classify a bit as, like, nostalgia, because it's, like, you know, I remember having a bunch of, like, cassettes and a bunch of CDs, and I had a water case for my CDs, and, like, those were really fun, and, you know, you really miss that, like, if you're listening to something digitally, you miss having it with you, and, like, the sound quality is different. And again, just going back to, like, the lyric book, because, like, one of my favorite things to do is, like, listen to the album, listen to the CD and read the lyric sheet and go through everything. And then I memorize everything. And it's so fun. You feel so accomplished, you know? And, you know, I think that's a part of it. And also maybe, like, they're very aesthetically pleasing. So, like, you can take a nice photo of a CD or a nice photo of, like, a vinyl record, or, and it looks really cool and looks really pretty, so that could be part of it too. Vinyl, I think vinyl, there's more interest almost, like, more people are getting into it, and, like, I know a lot of my friends have record players now, and are interested in going to, like, record stores and everything. So I think that's seeing a resurgence. So I think that's here for at least a little bit. I think it's so cool how just Adele releasing an album and Taylor Swift releasing, like, a couple albums and BTS releasing stuff has just skyrocketed the sales. Like, that's so cool. It's like two, like, single artists in a group. Like, that's nuts. you know, and to have that much of an impact on the economic side of things. So I don't think you can go wrong with having CDs or having vinyl, because you're going to enjoy them. Like, they're going to be cool. And in years to come, you know, when everything turns into a desert, they might have some value.
We'll be under sand.
Preserve them.
Yes.
I love CDs. I never stopped buying CDs. I started buying CDs in probably like 1993, and I've been buying them ever since. I don't think there's going to be some big CD resurgence. If only because people my age that collected CDs, to them, I guess the aesthetic is the record. You know, that's the cooler thing. And people younger than me, they never really had a real attachment to CDs. And that's kind of why I guess they had an attachment to cassettes. But even cassettes, really, people don't care about too much anymore because it's so commonplace now. So I do think it's a blip. And I think CDs will be produced for a while. But, cassettes never stopped being produced. They still produce cassettes, just – they became fewer and fewer. I think that's what's going to happen with CDs, which is a shame. I love CDs. I mean, I've got CDs that are 40 years old, older than me. That's not true. I've got CDs that are like 30 years old that sound brand new. You know, and a vinyl generally does wear out. I mean, you can take really good care of it and minimize that, but the fact of the matter is, anytime you play vinyl record, it is being used, where CD doesn't ever wear out, except for the counter argument is, sometimes the acid can eat itself out and the CD fails to play. But knock on wood, I haven't really had that happen. I hear people say, you know, vinyl's better. I lost my entire CD collection because they went bad. Well, I've got a lot of CDs. And I can't think of a time where it just stopped playing, you know. So I don't really believe that. I mean, CDRs, yes, but who gives a shit about CDRs? but I love CDs. But I also love vinyl records. I do agree that vinyl records have a different sound than CDs. It's because the high end, the high end of a record is cut off. So that's why a record does kind of have a, quote, more full sound. But it's not really more full sound. It's really more bassy sound. But I love records. I love how they're big. I like watch them spin around. And they're fun to get for a dollar. But I do think that the record boom is going to drop out. I think this year, I think the record boom is going to slightly drop off. And the year after that, it's going to be a significant drop off. And the third year, it's going to be another significant drop off. So I think within 3 years, the record craze will be over. I guess that's sad it's a good question. Because right now, used records are insanely expensive. Insanely expensive. Like we talked before, like a Cyndi Lauper record now, you might see it for $10, $15, $20. 3 years ago, that was here's another great example. Sam, I bought my copy of Misfits Walk Among Us original press for $25 in 2007, and that was the going price. What do you think that record costs now?
$300.
$600 to $1,000. You see, insane. Yeah. So it is kind of weird in that, and if we look at like cheap records, like Billy Joel records now are $10, $15, $20. Every Billy Joel record used to be a dollar. Now they're $10, $15, $20. Elton John records. So used record prices are through the roof, which is in a way good in that it keeps the record stores in business and people are having fun and they're out there buying records. But for the hardcore addicts like myself, it means records are more expensive. But luckily for myself and a lot of other fellow hardcore addicts, we've already got our Billy Joels and our Elton Johns. is the impact really that bad? You know, so I guess the answer is no. At any rate, I think it's cool. Vinyl's hot, but I see a couple pressing plants, and everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about. They're like, records make a great investment. No, records do not make a great investment. The only time a record makes a great investment is if you buy it today and you're intending to sell it tomorrow. If you're buying a record now and intending to increase in value over the next 3 years, don't do it. And the sickening part is the only people that are buying this are kids that don't know anything about records. You know what I mean? And these plants, and I'm saying it's plural, but it's really only singular, are preying on 15, 16, 17-year-old kids and creating this delusional idea that a new record will increase its value in 5 years. It won't, you know. If you want to make money buying – first of all, if you want to invest money, records not the way to go. But if you want to make some extra spare cash flipping records – buy it today, sell tomorrow. Don't buy it now and sell 2 years from now. It's not going to work out. That's the point. So anyways, it's cool that records and CDs are popular. I'm glad that people like the physical because, A, they sound way better than MP3s, and it shows that people – there is value in art, which is the argument I've been making all along, which is the exact argument that Spotify has been fighting against. that people do realize art is worth money and has value, and that's cool. So in a way, I mean, it's a good, you know, you see a lot of people like saying, yeah, you know, it takes so long to press a record. Yeah, it's a bummer, but at least people value art, you know, and that's kind of cool, you know?
Yeah.
And speaking of art, I'm going to let M. Moore talk about this, and Sam's going to react because I was not able to watch the video. But Kid Capici had released a new video with rising up-and-comer Bob Villain from England. The new song is called New England, and the video was directed by Nick Suchak, and it's a standalone single. So, M. Moore, tell us about the new Kid Capici video, and then Sam Barrett will tell us if she liked it, hated it, or, like, what's the deal, man?
All right, so Kid Capici, I had not heard of them before this song. Knew about the song because Bob Villain was hyping it, so I was like, gotta check it out. So Kid Capici, they're a punk band from Hastings in the UK. And they self-released their 2020 album this time next year. Just kind of cool. So the song, I really like the song. The song's really... It sounds very, like, big and, like, deep and, like, just bam, you know, like, hard-hitting. I listened to it, and it, like, it got me just, like, absolutely amped up. It was just ready to go, especially the chorus. Like, the chorus was really good. And, like, when it gets to Bob Villain, his feature is very good, too. It goes together very well. Their styles are pretty complementary as far as I can tell, because there's lots of words, but there's also some melodic parts. So I found it catchy. And I really liked the video. So in the video, they're mirroring what they're saying in the lyrics, like, almost perfectly. So... there's a part, the lyric is, all heroes, no villains. And when that comes on, there's a guy dressed as Batman and a guy dressed as the Joker beating each other up in an alleyway. And the singer just walks past. So you see it in the background. So there's a lot of stuff like that. Another thing, like, they're on a bus and they mention, like, a bowler hat, and a guy pulls out a bowler hat and puts it on. They hold up framed pictures of Bob the Builder and Pat the Postman when they're mentioned. There's a part where they're talking about, like, political apathy, and the singer walks by and points to a picture of Margaret Thatcher while the rest of the band that's on the end or on the outside of a covered bus stop, while the rest of the band standing inside the bus stop holding a paper or a cardboard sign that says Save the Arts. So there's a lot going on in the video, which I really love because there's just so much going on. It's great. And then part of the chorus is it you can't change or you won't change. And when it says that, when they say that, the band are in front of different landmarks around London, like they're by the Eye, they're by Buckingham Palace, and they hold up the sign, or they hold up signs that say won't change or can't change. So I want to check out more with Kid Capici because I really like this song. So if their other songs are like this, like, that'd be really, really cool. And you know, Bob Villain always kicks ass, so adding them just makes everything better. Sam, what did you think of New England?
So the video was very well done. It was very smart. It almost read like a movie in a way, right?
Yeah.
But the music. Oh my God. What the F was that? So I wasn't sure what it was. Like, it was kind of like a rap, like the way that he, like, you know, sings, I guess. And there was kind of like, I had some synthy parts in it that was like rocky synth. So I really did, none of this made sense to me whatsoever. I almost felt like I was in a club, like, and there was like a remix of this, like, in a club, like, while I'm, like, you know, dancing or whatever, because I was in a club once and Smell Like Teen Spirit was on, and I was like, wait, hold on, what's happening right now? So I had that, like, same moment, mm-hmm. yeah, like, with this, the Bob, like, when he came in, that part, that was cool. Yes, I do agree with you that his the way that he sings and, you know, is very complimentary to Keith Capici. But yeah, no, I'm not a fan of this. I don't need this in my life. everyone else can enjoy this if they like, but I'm just gonna go hide in the corner and be grouchy.
Well, speaking of grouchy people, the Melvins, although Buzz Osborne always says he's a happy-go-lucky kind of guy, but he's very intense. The Melvins have released a new EP. The EP is called Lord of the Flies, and it is out via Amphetamine Reptile Records, and it's got two new tracks and two covers. One cover is a Spoon Man featuring Matt Cameron of Soundgarden, and the other is a double cover. It's a cover of Led Zeppelin's Misty Mountain Hop merged with Devo's Uncontrollable Urge. I will kick this off. I will say this kicks ass. I mean, the Melvins released, I think, two albums last year. The Melvins released three albums, four albums, really. There was the Dale Crover solo album, two Melvins albums, and a live album. So the Melvins released four albums last year, and they're already off to their new album. No one knows what the new one's going to be called, but I will say a criticism of Melvin, the last 15 or 20 Melvins albums, is that it's more kind of classic rock and punky than it is classic Melvin sound. I would not levy that criticism because I love it when Melvins do a kind of punkier stuff or faster stuff or classic rock kind of stuff. That being said, this new track, Never Say You're Sorry, is very, I would say, late 90s Melvins. Honky era and Pigs of the Roman Empire era. And basically the era after the major label, but before the big Melvins era, if you will. And so I absolutely loved this song. I think it's fantastic. I think it's Melvins are so cool in that they put out so much. Melvins are extremely wise, and not every band has this option, is because they put out so many records. Here's an example. What's a band that puts out like an album every 4 years? I don't even like Red Hot Chili Peppers, but we'll use them as the example. You get one Red Hot Chili Peppers album every 4 years, and so because it is such a long wait, if it's not exactly what you want, you're bummed out. And the fact of the matter is, at this point, Red Hot Chili Peppers probably aren't going to put out a record that's comparable to Under the Bridge or something. Melvins put out so many records that some of them are straight up Melvins records, and you're like, hooray, it's the Melvins doing Melvins. And some of them are so whacked out in that there is no expectations, or you're never bummed out if it's not exactly what you want, because exactly what you want is going to come in the next 6 months or so. So it allows you to enjoy the weird experiment. You're like, oh, wow, they're doing something different this time. Let's check it out. So, and that is one of the things of putting out so much material. Not every band can do that. And the reason the Melvins can do that is because they own their own studio and they're incredibly talented and they can make enough money to do that, in that they don't have jobs. Well, they've got very time-consuming jobs, and that is being the Melvins, but they don't have other jobs. So the Melvins have handled their career, I would say, pretty much as wise as any band of their level of fame has. And but it's cool when we get straight up classic Melvins type stuff like this. That being said, Sam and them haven't heard it, but the Misty Mountain Urge track, which is Misty Mountain Hop blended into Uncontrollable Urge, it is phenomenal. It is awesome. I'm excited about this. I dig this. Sam and them, I don't know where you guys stand on the Melvins, if you guys think this or not, but it's so much fun to be. I mean, I've been a fan of the Melvins a long time now, but like being a Melvins fan is like one of the best fans there is, because there's always cool stuff coming out. It's like being a Zappa fan in the 70s, or a Bowie fan in their, you know, like mid 70s, or a Judas Priest fan in the 70s, or any good band in the 70s. There's always stuff coming out, and it rocks, and I'm psyched.
I'm glad you're psyched.
Sam, you have not gotten into the Melvins yet?
No, it's not happening.
Em, I'd be interested to see where you stand with the Melvins.
I haven't listened to a lot of them, and I don't really know why. I haven't, but I like the song. I the like the band sounds so good, and they have like a like it gets heavy, you know, and I wasn't expecting that. I don't know, but like it sounds so cool, you know, like I thought the song was really good, and they are like they are one of the bands that it's like, oh yeah, I need to check them out, and I should check them out, and I know I'll probably like them because I like, you know, these other bands and just haven't gotten around to it, but I really did like this song. It has like a like kind of like a an ominous vibe to it, kind of like it's kinda, like slightly creepy in parts that I kind of got, which was pretty cool. And yeah, just their output's insane. Like they never rest. Like that's really commendable. Like good for them. You know, that's awesome.
And here's Never Say You're Sorry by the Melvins. we're back. And let's see what else we got to talk about. Oh! The tables have turned, Sam Barrett. The tables have turned. or should I say the tiny desk has turned. Turnstile has released one of these NPR tiny desk sessions, which is basically a band doing a short PC in front of a little desk. They did 7 tracks from their latest album called Glow On. Sam, Turnstile, sitting at a little keyboard and sitting down, surrounded by stuffed animals. Fantastic or silly and stupid?
Oh, this is so fantastic! One, I just want to hug the walls, okay? Like, they just look so cute and cuddly. Like, I kind of just want to hug the walls and maybe roll around in the walls. Like, I just love it. I love the background. I love the fact that they reimagined some songs. Like, pretty much the keyboard. So they did 7 songs. They did Endless Water, Underwater Boy, Blackout, Don't Play, Mystery, TLC, which is like my favorite one right now, and Alien Love Call. The freaking keyboards in Mystery. Oh my freaking God. It is like so, so good. I've actually watched this a couple times. I've actually had conversations with other people about this because it's so damn good. Yeah, I do like Tiny Desk concerts in general. And this one is definitely up there now. I was actually really happy to see that this was like this because they did a performance on Seth Meyers recently, and that I think the sound quality wasn't so good, but that's network TV, so I guess that's what they do. They don't know what rock sounds. Yeah, so this brings me joy, okay? I'm really, really happy about this, and I hope people love this as much as I do.
And more, did you love it as much as Sam did?
I really like the background. The background is so cool, and in the description, it's they say it's called Alien Love Response. And it was created by John Scharback of Give. I think that's how you say his name. So that was just a really cool tie-in. I don't like Glow On. I have really given it a try. I can't get into it.
You a turnstile? What a crime!
Don't worry, Em. I still like you.
Thanks. But, like, it's one of those things, I respect what they're doing, and I think it's great that they're getting all these opportunities, because people are going to watch it, and then they're going to get into, like, hardcore punk, and they're going to discover all sorts of different bands. That was the other thing. This was filmed by Sunny Singh, who's Hate56, yeah. And his videos are amazing. I love his videos so much. So that was just really cool. It's nice that they're, like, bringing him along, too, and everything's good that way. But, yeah, no, yeah, it's just so good. But I couldn't get into the music, so yeah, not for me.
M didn't like this. What's wrong with M? I can't believe she didn't like this.
It's okay. Like
no, it's not okay.
I have to leave punk news now.
M has exited the hovercraft room.
Or wrote it off the hovercraft. Okay, anyway, no. Listen, speaking of people that have overstayed their welcome, Interrupters are going to release a new album. It's going to be the 4th one, and it's going to follow Fight the Good Fight from 2018. And I will say, and honestly, I'm being overly harsh on the Interrupters. I keep going back and forth on the Interrupters, and it's the ska revival right now, and I do like a lot. Well, I do like some, and by some, I mean like 2 of the modern ska bands. And honestly, in an early article, punk, you know, we talked about, you know, the ska revival, and we, you know, we talked about the bands we've mentioned 100 times now that are leading the ska revival, and someone's like, Punk News forgot that it was the Interrupters leading the ska revival, not these other bands, you know, you stupid assholes. And I'm like, well, I feel as though there is actually like a gap of about 3 years or 2 years between the last Interrupters album and the explosion of the current ska bands. I feel as though they might not even really be that connected, frankly. That being said, I'm going a little bit off track. The last Interrupters album, Fight the Good Fight, I like that album a lot, honestly. I still play that album about once every few months. It's catchy. It sounds good. The only thing is, it's not a very deep album. I don't feel as though there's really much to think about. It's really just like, you know, same issue with the Tim Armstrong solo album, A Poet's Life. Is it sounds good, but there doesn't feel like there's a whole lot actually there, you know. That being said, I do like the Interrupters. I still would like to see them live, even though I haven't. But am I super excited about this? No, I'll check it out. But the other question is, it's interesting, now that the Ska Revival is back in full swing, does that mean the Interrupters are going to come and, you know, reclaim the crown? Everyone's going to be like, yeah, Interrupters are great. Or has the time of the Interrupters passed? I feel like because there was a 4 to 5 year delay between the last album and this one, I feel like maybe the steam is gone. I think maybe the torch has been passed. And more, the Interrupters, are they going to reappear and then everyone's going to pay tribute to them? Or they're going to reappear but everyone won't know because everyone's going to be watching Catfight on the other side of the stage?
I think they're going to be overshadowed because there are so many ska bands. There's so many, like, ska bands that actually get into things. Like get into issues and have lyrics that mean something. Again, not trying to like bash the Interrupters. I never got into them. I heard She's Kerosene a couple times on the radio. That was fun. But there's something about them. I can't get into them. So I think the people who are already fans will check it out and they'll love it. And I think the people who aren't already fans probably won't. And I don't know how much momentum they'll gain. Again, who knows? Could be proven wrong. Could be the hit of the summer, the album of the year. But I don't think it'll be mine. Sam, what do you think?
So I actually like the Interrupters. I've actually seen them. I'm actually baffled that you haven't seen them, John. But anyways.
That's one of the things I can't see. And it's like, oh, the Interrupters are playing on a Tuesday. It's like, yeah, I'll catch them next time. Oh, they're playing on a Saturday. Oh, but also, you know, Downtown Boys is playing. Well, I'll go see Downtown Boys. You know, I do want to see them. I just hasn't happened. And frankly, if I wanted to make the effort, I could have. And I haven't. And that's on me.
Well, I also believe that, like, who the hell cares if they have to reclaim a throne or not? Why can't they just exist? Because, like, you know, if they want to put things out, the people like me that already likes them will continue to follow them. You know, they have been put on, like, really big tours. So I'm sure this last tour that they went on, they probably gained some, you know, Green Day Weezer fans, which I don't know how to feel about that, but whatever. yeah, so, you know, I do think that this little announcement that they put together was super cute. Like, he's playing the piano and he's playing, like, you know, like a New Year's song, and he just pretty much says Happy New Year, and I'm like, oh, yay! It is a Happy New Year. We're getting a record. I have no real hard feelings whether or not crowns need to be reclaimed or not. It's ska.
Well, there you have it. We will see if the Interrupters train keeps rolling along or if that's it. Well, let's see here. I guess one other thing is, do you guys think that Tim Armstrong will have as much as a strong hand in this one as he has in the past three releases? Will this be, like, here's the question. Will this be Tim Armstrong and the Interrupters part 4? Or is this the part where they part ways and now we're going to get true Interrupters without the influence of Tim Armstrong?
I guess we'll know soon.
Fair enough. Okay. Let's see what else we got to talk about today. Two things. This one's kind of a bummer, and well, maybe it's not a bummer to some people. David Bowie has sold – I'm sorry, not David Bowie. The estate of David Bowie has sold David Bowie's publishing for about $250 million to Warner Chappell Music, or Warner Chappell Music, rather. Of course, Warner Chappell and other – I guess – music companies, like yourself, have been buying publishing massive amounts of publishing from other artists. They bought Bruce Springsteen for $500 million. They bought Stevie Nicks for like $100 million, I think. I think the Tom Petty estate sold that publishing. Publishing is getting sold right and left, which is crazy to me because music now is worth less than it's ever been. And yet these people are putting massive, massive investments into the publishing, which is easier to rip off now more than ever. So I don't want to be Mr. Conspiracy Theory, but I'm like, why are all these entities this year spending these massive, massive amounts to buy publishing when it seems as though publishing isn't worth anything right now? Do they know something we don't know? Or are they doing the wise thing? You know, you buy a house when the market's bad and you sell a house when the market's good. Maybe that's what they're doing, you know? Honestly, $250 million – for the entirety of David Bowie's publishing seems low to me, frankly. I mean, I already realize $250 million is a lot of money, but as an example, Rock and Roll Part 2 by, what's his name, Gary Glitter, that's one song. Everyone knows the song. Hey! That song they played the ball games. That one song keeps him rich. Actually, I think did Gary Glitter pass away or did he just go to jail finally in the UK? I think he went to jail finally in the UK. Oh, well, you guys know the whole Gary Glitter thing, right? Do you guys know that?
No.
Do you guys want to know about it? Sure. Gary Glitter is – this is – so anyways, everyone knows the massive hit Rock and Roll Part 2. It actually is a pretty good song. I've got the album. It actually is a pretty good song. You know, Sam, you know the song I'm talking about, M? Hey,
Yeah.
Hey, right. Like the song you play every
song. You should just do that like over and over and over for the rest of this podcast.
so that song gets played at every ball game, and it doesn't even really get. It gets played on the radio once in a while, but the only place it really gets played is at sports stadiums. The publishing from that one song keeps Gary Glitter in the millions. He's got no. He doesn't have. As long as they keep playing that one song in the ball games, that's it. He's getting millions of dollars per year from that one song. So anyways, Gary Glitter is rich. And so what does he decide to do with all his money? Well, he decides to go to Vietnam. And what does he do in Vietnam? He pays for sexual relations with young boys. So he gets kicked out of Vietnam. And so when you get kicked out of Vietnam for having sexual relations with young boys, what do you do? Do you say to yourself, you know, I need to clean up my act. Or do you do what Gary Glitter did, and then you go to the Philippines and get kicked out of the Philippines for having sexual relations with young boys? And so after you get kicked out of Vietnam and the Philippines for having sexual relations – I'm sorry, young girls. It looks like young girls, which is a very horrible thing to say – to do, rather, and to say, but to do. What would the average person – would they say, you know, I really need to clean up my act. I need to stop having sex with young people. No, he goes to Malaysia and gets arrested and kicked out of Malaysia for having sex with young – people again, young children again. And so finally he gets sent back to England where he's arrested and he's now in jail. But I will say this is a guy that is really dedicated to being a pedophile and that he's gotten kicked out of three countries for being a pedophile. You'd think after the first one, you'd be like, you know, I made some bad choices in my life. I need to straighten up. No, Gary Glitter's like, no, I'll just go to a different country. You know, no problem. You know, so anyway, anytime you hear that song, hey, that's keeping the world one of the world's most notorious pedophiles paid. Just remember that. We had the ball game.
Oh, my God. This is not good. Oh, no. How did we get down here?
Matters, publishing, I'll tell you, I'm trying to describe the import of the issue here in that having one hit song can set you up for life. Like, if you have a song, like, you know, like I'm trying to, like what song, like on the radio, they always play Black Dog by Led Zeppelin. That one song keeps the guys in Led Zeppelin rich, you know, or George Michael's Careless Whisper. I realize George Michael's passed away. That one song keeps the state rich. One song, Chumbawamba, I mean, I'm not going to dive too deep, you know, I Get Knocked Down. That one song, I'm sure, keeps the people in Chumbawamba on easy street, more or less, you know, one song. And so publishing is very valuable, even though right now publishing is worth less than it's ever been. And I still think $250 million for David Bowie, you know, look, Ground Control to Major Tom, Ziggy Stardust, Let's Dance, Fashion, hit after hit after hit after hit. That's only $250 million. It seems very low to me. But I'm going to have to go off on a kind of an explanation here. And then we can just issue a hand. People say, John, what is the publishing? So in intellectual property, we kind of break songs up into two things. There's the sound recording, and then there's the composition. the composition is the song written on a piece of paper or the notes to the song. So, for example, the song Johnny Be Good is a composition, and then there's many sound recordings of artists, you know, playing that. There's the Chuck Berry sound recording. There's the Elton John sound recording. There's the Judas Priest sound recording. There's the Michael J. Fox sound recording. There are many, many sound recordings of Johnny Be Good, but there's one composition. That is the song written on a piece of paper by Chuck Berry. So there's the composition, and the sound recordings stem from that. You guys understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
Okay, so in the entertainment law, we talk about it in a slightly different term, which is confusing. I really wish they would use the intellectual property term, but they don't. In entertainment law, we say there's publishing, which is the rights that stem from a written composition. And then we say masters, which a master, more or less, very roughly speaking, is a sound recording. But it actually technically isn't. Technically, a master is a final studio or live recording that has been produced and mastered and delivered to a record label or other entity for commercial release, as opposed to a demo, which technically a demo isn't a master, but it's almost the same thing. So anyways, publishing is the rights that are associated with a song composition. Anytime a song is played on the radio, the people that own the publishing, that is the songwriters, or the people that have sold the rights, that have bought the rights from the songwriters, get paid. Anytime a song is played in a bar, if there's a license. Anytime a song is played at a sports stadium. Anytime a song is on TV. The person that wrote that song or has sold the rights to someone else, that person gets paid. That's why publishing is very powerful. And you actually make more money from publishing than sound recordings, because publishing has automatic licenses. That means so long as a radio station, so long as a sports stadium, so long as a bar pays the RIA fee, then they can play whatever songs they want, and the people that own the publishing get paid, and they never gave their permission. By contrast, in order for a sound recording to be played in a commercial or in a TV show or in a movie, that has to be negotiated. So publishing is incredibly lucrative. Sound recordings are too, but publishing is automatically lucrative, if that makes any sense, if the song is popular. So what David Bowie has sold, what Bruce Springsteen has sold, what Stevie Nicks has sold is the rights associated with the composition, the publishing, not the sound recordings, because David Bowie doesn't own the sound recordings. David Bowie licensed the sound recordings to RCA Records, and now Parlophone, many, many, many years ago. And so we are talking about two separate things. What complicates it why this is so important is because anytime they want to play a David Bowie sound recording in a commercial, like there's a million drug commercials now, you know, let's say they want to play Ground Control for Major Tom, Space Oddity in a song for constipation medicine, right? Well, they have to license the sound recording, but then they also have to get the rights to the composition. And until, you know, last month, the David Bowie stake and say, no, we don't want you to play our song in your constipation commercial because David Bowie isn't about that. Now that David Bowie has sold it to a third party, that's all out the window, and now it is no longer an artistic attachment. It is strictly an item of commerce, which, you know, who really cares? I mean, like, we all know David Bowie's great. We all know Stevie Nicks is great. If they want to play that music in, you know, a constipation commercial, do we really care? But it is troublesome, and it's saddening to see art that is so powerful being kind of taken away from the person or the estate that created it. You know, it's a loss of control of your own art. There is something about like if you build a car and sell it, you're like, yeah, you know, fine. You know, I built a car and I sold it. But for some reason, when you create art, it does kind of hurt to lose complete control of that art. It's not yours anymore, even though it came out of you, which is art is somewhat unique in that fashion. And so now the David Bowie thing has made the decision to completely sell all the rights to the David Bowie stuff. And the David Bowie family or the estate no longer has any of the control over David Bowie's music whatsoever, which seems saddening to me. And now the counter argument is, well, you know what, John, the David Bowie estate, I mean, it is the full-time jobs of multiple people to manage David Bowie's publishing, just that alone, right? So maybe the family doesn't want that burden, or maybe they're not best able to exploit it. But on the other hand, I mean, David Bowie's son is Duncan Jones, a famous filmmaker. His wife is Iman, a famous model. So I think David Bowie's family, and I don't know exactly who owns the David Bowie estate, frankly, maybe none of them do, but I assume his children own some of it. I was thinking that Duncan Jones, an internationally famous movie guy, has the capability to adequately control the David Bowie publishing or hire somebody that can do it for him, you know? So I don't really buy the argument that, well, maybe his family didn't have the ability to manage it. I don't know, man. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do. I'm saying it's just sad. But on the other hand, it's not like publishing lasts forever. Publishing only lasts life of the author plus 70 years. So there's only 65 years left of David Bowie's publishing to have any value, after which it's free for anybody. So we're not talking about infinity. We're only talking about 65 years. So I don't know. Em, did you have any feelings with regards to this?
The statement that was released... that the songs will be cherished and taken care of with the greatest level of dignity. Sounds weird. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's going to happen. Because if there's anything that businessmen have proven over the past 10 years, they treat things with respect and dignity, you know.
Yeah, I'm kind of scared what's going to happen with it, but... Yeah, like you said, John, only 65 more years, then it's the people's. Sam, what did you think?
So if the state feels like they don't want to manage this or cash out now, right? Because I think that's the other thing. It's like, you know, they're cashing out now for what, like $250 million or whatever. I was like, So they're getting that now. So they're not waiting for years or whatever for it to come. I'm not even sure what it looks like how much money that can be generated if they do license out like a song or something like that. You know, if they feel like this is what they want to do, I'm sure they made their decision. I personally have an issue with my own art. I don't like giving it away or like, you know, like I just have an issue about that. So like, I do have an issue that like all of these artists are like, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to sell it and let you guys deal with it. Because if I listen to a David Bowie song, I'm going to think David Bowie. I'm not going to think about, you know, Warner Chappell Music and publishing, like, you know, what they're doing with it. You know, when John was going on his little talk right now, his soapbox talk, which is a good one. I, for some strange reason, I think it's like a Samsung commercial for a phone, and they have like "I Want It That Way" by Backstreet Boys on it. I'm like that came back in my brain. I'm like, is this something that, like, you know, I want to think about? Like, if they license this out to like a constipation medication, I was like, do I really want to think every time I hear the song, I think about constipation medication? You know, like, cause I know every time I'm going to see a Samsung phone, that song, "I Want It That Way," might pop up in my head now. So, yeah, I have mixed feelings about this. I don't know. This is weird. I don't know why people want to sell their stuff, but if they need to, I guess they're doing it.
There has to be some sort of reason as to why there's all these massive sale of publishing rights over the past year. I mean, it all happened at once, you know?
Yeah.
I wonder what it is. Somebody knows something I don't know, but, you know, that's par for the course. Here's one other legal quandary. And I'm particularly proud of Punk News because we reported this more accurately than every single other website out there. So as the listeners surely know, the baby on the cover of Nirvana's Nevermind, Spencer Reldon, he's suing Nirvana for child porn and for exploitation of his image because it's got a naked baby on the cover of the album. Last month, Nirvana filed a motion to dismiss that said, A, it's not porno, and B, it's not you're beyond the statute of limitations. When in federal court and in state court, but this is in federal court. In federal court, when a motion is filed, state court is a different time, but in federal court, you have 14 days to respond to the motion. If you don't respond to the motion, the judge can either automatically rule on behalf of the filing party or take some other action. And usually a judge will say, if you don't file a response, then I'm just going to rule on behalf of the filing party. And so here, Nirvana filed a motion that says, it's not child porn, and it's beyond the statute of limitations, so we win, you lose, you can't file this lawsuit. And weirdly, Spencer Eldon's attorneys did not file a response. And so everyone said, the case has been dismissed. Oh, but he can also file an amended complaint. And I realized that there's a small thing that I don't fully understand the terminology. In law, it's extremely common for when a lawsuit is filed to either file what's called preliminary objections or demurrer or 12b6 or failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted that says, you can't sue me and here's why, or you can't sue me for that and here's why, or you can sue me but you haven't alleged what you have to allege, so you have to go away. And so almost every case has that initial battle, if you will. And I've had those battles many times, both on the party filing the motion and the party opposing the motion side. And so when a party files, we'll just call it a motion to dismiss, the judge usually – I mean if the motion is successful, the judge will usually grant the motion with leave to amend. And I realize I don't believe that the case is dismissed. Because if you refile with leave to amend, the case number is the same. And so in an order, a judge grants the motion with leave to amend, but he doesn't order a dismissal of the case. They usually say, motion granted with leave to amend in 10 days. If the motion is not amended, if the complaint is not amended in 10 days, the case will be dismissed. And I haven't seen these papers, and I don't feel like spending the $7 to look at them. So I'm pretty sure what happened here is Nirvana filed a motion to dismiss. Spencer Allen's attorney didn't file a response, and we'll talk about that in a second. So the judge ruled on behalf of Nirvana, but essentially the judge gave them leave to amend. So he didn't dismiss the case. He granted the motion but gave leave to amend and did not dismiss the case. Everyone said the case is dismissed, which is the end of the lawsuit. That's not what happened here. Here, leave was granted, which means – although the judge was saying that the petition by Nirvana's attorneys was correct, the arguments presented were correct because Spencer Eldon did not file an answer, if he can correct those deficits, then he can refile an amended complaint. And that's literally what happened today. Spencer Eldon filed an amended complaint. And I'm pretty sure it's under the same case number. I'm almost definitely sure that it is. So that means the case wasn't dismissed. He just filed an amended complaint. So everyone said, the case is dismissed. The case is dismissed. No, the case wasn't dismissed. The motion was granted, forcing Spencer Eldon to amend his complaint. And that's where we're at now. That being said, Nirvana can file a second motion to dismiss and saying, well, even though he's amended the complaint, he hasn't corrected the initial problems, or now he's got new problems, which is almost definitely what Nirvana is going to do. They've got him on the ropes, presumably. Usually – now let's step back. Usually when one party files a motion to dismiss – we'll use an example here. If Nirvana says – you know, it's not child pornography and you're beyond the statute of limitations, what one would expect Spencer Eldon to do, even if he thinks he's going to lose, file a response that says, no, in fact, it is not child – I mean, it is child pornography and we're not beyond the statute of limitations. That's what you would expect him to do. But here they just didn't file a response at all. And that might be because they realized they were going to lose. It might be because Spencer Eldon isn't paying his attorneys, although I would bet this is a contingency fee case. Or just could be mismanagement, or it could be a tactical way just to burn up Nirvana's resources, which I don't think I'd recommend fighting the battle in that exact fashion. It seems too risky to me. So the point being is there's many reasons why a motion to dismiss would be granted with leave to amend, and it's not near the end of the case. And so we're still in the midst of the battle here, although it might be over relatively shortly. But I was surprised that Spencer Eldon's attorney didn't file a response at all. It could have been a tactical decision or it could be a sign of chaos within internally. I was surprised they didn't respond. I mean, I've never done that. I certainly have had cases where a party didn't file a response to a motion to dismiss, either because they had problems on their end or the issues brought up. They didn't want to fight. They didn't want to waste their money fighting. They were happy to let me win on those points and then fight the other points out in the upcoming case. So I realize I'm throwing a lot at you, but I am surprised that in a case this big, he didn't, or this important, presumably, he didn't file a response, particularly when he was facing getting kicked out of court altogether, which the judge could have done, but the judge didn't. And honestly, it's relatively rare, not rare, but usually a judge does give you a chance to fix up the complaint, but sometimes they just knock you out. If, I mean, if you're way off base, they'll just kick you right out, you know, but usually they give you a chance to fix it if you can. But I'm surprised that the Spencer et al.'s attorneys had the guts, I say, to risk totally getting kicked out of court altogether. Now, I haven't seen any of the pleadings, and like I said, I don't want to spend the $7 to do that. So maybe if I saw the pleadings, I'd have a different perspective. But from the public reports that we've seen, it does appear that, Nirvana filed a motion to kick it out, and Spencer Allen didn't file a response, but they did file an amended complaint, meaning the case was not dismissed as reported by many other websites. So, yeah, I realize there's a lot of information. Does that make sense, or are you guys – is your head spinning?
That makes sense. That is a lot of information. Thank you, lawyer, for that. Yeah, I don't know. I like when this entire thing came up that this kid was suing Nirvana, I was like, literally, I was like, there was photos of you anyways, in Nirvana shirts. Like, you know, his baby, I guess, picture. There was also photos of him recreating it. So I'm like, how is this, like, why are you even doing this? You know?
Because he wants money.
Clearly he wants money. Like, normally, like, my brain goes to, like, you know, his parents must have had this photo or got this photo taken. There must have been some kind of signing of something to, like, release the image somewhere. Because if this was going to an album art, because I think at the, yeah, Nirvana was on a major label at that point, right?
Well,
yeah.
Nirvana constructed the shoot, and they paid Spencer Eldon's parents to use Spencer Eldon as a model for the album cover. And that's why he's suing for child porn and exploitation, because he has no copyright infringement or likeness in unfair use of unauthorized use of likeness, because his parents signed those rights away 30 some years ago.
Exactly. So I'm like honestly, I'm like, I don't know. Like, this entire case blows my mind why this is happening. I'm like, just leave Nirvana alone. Yes, they have a lot of money or something. But, like, you know, like, literally just leave it alone. I was like, if I looked at him and I looked at his, like, if I saw him on the street and, like, I wouldn't actually pinpoint that he's their Nirvana baby. So it's not like he's, like, you know, there's, like, I don't know, he's scarred.
And more. What do you think?
It's not child pornography. He does just want money. I'm positive he's holding a grudge against them because of that. They didn't play his art thing. And, like, here, you know, the optics just, they look so bad. Everything looks so bad for him. You know, like, why would you continue to put yourself through this, you know, like, at the beginning of this, I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt, because it's like, you know, people deal with things differently, and if there was something that maybe we didn't know about that happened, you know, like, that would obviously change the story a great deal, but it, you know, it doesn't sound like it. It just sounds like, yep, I'm gonna say this because I have milked it for years and I need more cash. So, like, I want Nirvana to win, and I want this to be over, because I really don't see the benefit of dragging this out, to be completely honest.
Everyone hates this guy Spencer Eldon. Like I said before, I have some sympathy for him in that, you know what, he's on one of those famous album covers of all time, and he didn't really get paid any. I think his parents got paid like $500, you know. And so yeah, it's a bummer and it sucks, but it's not Nirvana's fault. I mean, you know, the law's the law, the deal's the deal. Your parents cut the deal, It sucks, dude. I feel his pain, but doesn't mean Nirvana has to pay for his pain because they didn't do anything wrong. But what I'm more interested in is I really want to know why didn't Spencer Elton's attorneys file a response? Are they playing it risky, or is there internal discord? But also, presumably, that since Nirvana filed a motion claiming statute of limitations and it's not pornographic, I don't know what legs he has left to stand on. So what else can he sue for? I think that's about it. So I'm thinking this one's going to get wiped out pretty soon. I would love to see what Spencer Elden's battle plan was, because it seemed like there wasn't one. Now, like I said at the beginning, I thought he was just trying to beat everybody down for 10 to 30 grand. You know, there's like 15 defendants. You get 30 grand each from 15 defendants. That's $450,000. You know, your attorney's going to take half of that after taxes. You get about 100, 150 grand, you know, quick hit and run. But I'm surprised it didn't end up that way. But maybe Nirvana did say, listen, kid, we'll give you $10,000 each. Go away. We don't want to waste our money doing this. And maybe they said, no, we want the big cash cow. And so Nirvana's probably like, all right, then we'll fight you to the end and you're going to lose, which is exactly what's happening. So I we'll never know, but I would like to know what was going on in the internal battle here, because there are some odd behavioral aspects on the outside looking in, and we'll never know what's going on within, you know? So it's interesting. So we mentioned child porn twice with Gary Glitter and with Nirvana. And more. You got a song for us, or like, what's the deal here?
Sure. So, should I do something that ties in or something completely different?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
You play some Michael Jackson or something.
Oh. Oh boy.
Not gonna do that.
As a side note, I mean, we all know that, like, have you guys like now that the whole Michael Jackson thing is like long done, like what a freaky scene that looked like. Honestly, like, the parents that, like, let their kids run around Michael Jackson's house, like, they're almost as guilty as Michael Jackson. Like, they know what's going down. You know, like Sam, can you imagine, like Sam, you don't have any nieces and nephews or cousins. Well, Chris has got a lot of cousins, right?
Yeah.
Imagine letting, like, a six-year-old cousin stay over Michael Jackson's house when, he's sleeping in the same bed as them. And, it's a creepy scene, man. Like, whew.
There's so many red flags in everything you just said right now. It's a hell's no.
I know. It's like, man.
Anyways, don't play that, okay?
So, there goes my plan. I'm going to play a song by Tits Up. They are a Liverpool-based punk band, and they just released their debut EP called Greatest Tits, and this is Birthday Party.
My birthday party. birthday party. You're not invited to my birthday party. Look in the mirror, you piece of shit. Have you seen yourself? Have you seen yourself?
Hits up, and before the podcast started, like M said the name, but I thought she was saying it's up, so I like made her repeat the name like seven times. I thought she was saying it's up. I'm like, what's the name? She's like, tits up. I'm like, it's up. She's like, tits up. I'm like, it's up. You know. So anyway, that in retrospect, that was very awkward, but that's just because it was a bad connection. Anyways, you can always use the podcast at punkfuse.org. This was kind of an odder episode, you know. So next week is the end of the year wrap up, and so and more. Are you excited for the end of the year wrap up, and we can get out of the this questionable topics? Let me address.
I'm very excited for the end of year wrap up of lots of cool music to talk about.
Sammy B, are you excited for the end of the year wrap up next week?
I'm super excited to get out of this conversation right now.